From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Things got ugly on the campaign trail this week. Police say protesters attacked supporters of Donald Trump last night outside a Trump rally in San Jose. And today, conservative writer Eric Erickson, no fan of Trump's, is calling on Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders to denounce the violence, just as they called on Trump to denounce violence by his supporters a few months back.
Meanwhile, also yesterday, Hillary Clinton excoriated Donald Trump's foreign policy chops.
He is not just unprepared. He is temperamentally unfit to hold an office that requires knowledge, stability, and immense responsibility.
And Trump fired back.
Hillary is not a talented person. In fact, she's a person with absolutely no natural talent. All you have to do is watch her speak.
And earlier in the week, Trump called reporters dishonest sleazes and said an Hispanic judge presiding over Trump University lawsuits has a conflict of interest because of his Mexican heritage. And still, our jinglers remain so resolutely cheery.
Here and now, 2016.
All right, then. Joining
nothing us, gets them down.
I know, nothing. Joining us, Jesse Holland, manager of the AP Politics social media accounts. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm good. And Rick Klein, political director of ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
Rick, start with you. Were you surprised at the ferocity in the Clinton speech yesterday?
I was. This is the Hillary Clinton that supporters of hers have been asking for, begging for almost. And talking to the Clinton campaign, they've been saying, we're not going to play his game. We're not going to play to his tempo, to his pace. I think we're seeing a shift, though, very quickly here, even before the general election, fully is engaged. That was an energized, enthusiastic, and a well-read-in Hillary Clinton that read that speech and went forward with the argument. And I think there were so many elements to that we're going to see over the next 5 months. But I think it was an important one, even before she closes out Bernie Sanders in the primaries, to put herself on record like that.
Well, pick up Bernie Sanders in a moment. But she pointed out that Trump has said families of terrorists are fair game. And she came back last night with, oh, yeah, the SEALs who killed bin Laden made the women and children safe first. That's honor, on and on. She called Trump too dangerous, too thin-skinned. Let's listen.
Donald Trump's ideas aren't just different. They are dangerously incoherent. They're not even really ideas, just a series of bizarre rants, personal feuds, and outright lies.
Jesse Holland, is this her Daisy ad moment? There's that ad that was aimed at Goldwater by Johnson, you know, 30, 40 years ago. It shows a little girl picking petals from daisies and then a nuclear explosion. In other words, the message, Goldwater is dangerous. And it worked. It's, and by the way, it's gone viral again. We'll post it at hereandnow.org. It's now gone viral. Is there some tie-in here, Jesse? Is this her moment for that?
Well, this is the first real volley from Hillary Clinton for the general election. She's now looking beyond the primary against Bernie Sanders and squarely looking at what's going to be happening in the election during this fall and telling voters where she stands and why she doesn't think Donald Trump deserves to be president. Now, this is a calculated risk by Hillary Clinton, because keep in mind, she still has that primary coming up, and you have Republicans who will turn around and look at her and say, well, we don't trust you either. But she's now making her case to the American people why Donald Trump shouldn't be elected, and waiting to see if it sticks.
Right. And Jesse, to the point you made, the RNC slammed some of Hillary Clinton's own foreign policy efforts, saying that military intervention in Libya was dubbed, quote, Hillary's war, and now Libya is a safe haven for terrorists. And you mentioned Bernie Sanders. He, in a statement, once again reminded people about her vote for the war in Iraq. So, I mean, Rick, does Hillary's foreign policy experience here, it helps her in a certain way, but does it also hurt her?
I think you're seeing her go on offense on this, but there is a definite downside. And I think Donald Trump already swinging back and saying she didn't answer the phone during her proverbial 3 a.m. moment, you're going to hear that again. And I think there's a case to be made against her on foreign policy that will be prosecuted by Republicans, by Donald Trump. But she feels comfortable here. I mean, look, this is someone who knows the subject matter better than just about anyone who's run for president. And she feels like she's on solid ground. And in making this broad case, I think we're going to hear this a lot over the next 5 months, that Donald Trump, it's not just that he would be unfit or would be unpopular or unwise to choose him, but that he would be dangerous. The idea that choosing him would be put America at risk is something that the Clinton campaign is going to want to come back to a lot.
Yeah, well, she went very deep on a lot of Netty issues. He did not. Here he is summing up his foreign policy last night.
We don't win anymore. We're going to start winning. We're going to win with our military. We're going to knock the hell out of ISIS. We have no choice. We're going to knock the hell out of them. We're going to win at our border. We're going to build the wall. It's going to be a big, fat, beautiful wall.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's what his people want to hear. You got to think that maybe Hillary Clinton's going after Republicans who just cannot vote for Donald Trump. But certainly his people, this is what they want to hear, and they heard it. But, Jesse, let's take a look at this week that was for Donald Trump. The PGA,
right.
Yeah, the PGA announced it's moving a golf event to Mexico instead of holding it at what his place in Miami. They couldn't find a sponsor. He won the endorsement of House Speaker Paul Ryan, but quietly in Ryan's hometown paper. He told Trump told the Santa Fe, New Mexico newspaper that he'd like to have the endorsement of Republican Governor Susana Martinez. But a week ago, he said she was terrible. And then, of course, there's that, you know, saying that a judge in the lawsuits against him has a conflict of interest. We repeated this last night because of his Mexican heritage. I mean, how would you rate that? For his people, that might be a good week.
Well, it's definitely a new week for a bunch of new firsts for a presidential candidate. It's no way to judge anymore. Every week, it seems that it's something completely different, something we've never seen a presidential candidate do before, comes out of his mouth. He says something completely different. So maybe his campaign staff thinks that, hey, if he keeps shooting from the hip, that's what the American people want to hear, someone who's willing to say whatever they think at that moment instead of a measured response.
Yeah, but let me just ask you, do you think that he might, as some have speculated, he could be held in contempt of court for his criticism of the judge?
Well, let's just say that in all my years covering federal courts, including the Supreme Court, I have never heard a plaintiff publicly chastise and talk about a judge in the way that he has. If I were his lawyers, I would hope that and pray that he wins the presidency. So maybe the judges and the federal judges will give them a break. Otherwise, he may be looking at a very upset federal judiciary as a private citizen come December.
Rick, actually, I'm dying to hear your thoughts about this, too.
Well, I think that this is something that even his most ardent supporters are going to have a hard time defending. I mean, this is attacking centuries of jurisprudence, American tradition, the idea of an impartial judiciary. His suggestion that simply based on a judge's ethnicity, that by itself would be a conflict of interest, not because of even this case, but because of other things Donald Trump has said. It doesn't even square with what Donald Trump has said, which is his public claim that Latinos love him. But even beyond that, the idea that that's inherently disqualifying is not true. That's not how it works. And it is pretty darn close to racist sentiments to suggest that simply ethnicity alone would disqualify someone.
I think
this is very, very difficult ground for him.
I started hearing some people this morning on the morning show saying, well, actually, I'm a child of Irish immigrants. What does he think? That's starting to penetrate. But Bernie Sanders, I just want to pick up here because he thinks he can win in California. But he also picked up on something that's going to be talked about, Republicans and climate change. Now, Donald Trump is going to Scotland next week, in part to visit a golf course there. He denies climate change, but his golf course is requesting special ruling to build a wall to stave off the water rising from climate change. So here's Bernie Sanders last night.
People all over California, all over America, have got to stand up and call Donald Trump and the other Republicans what they are. And that is to acknowledge that this denial of climate change is an incredible threat.
Jesse, people are floating all over America. It's horrible, the weather that we're seeing. Do you think this is going to be an issue?
It's going to have to be an issue. I mean, there are very few serious people on the planet left who can deny that the oceans are rising, that can deny the weather that's happening in the United States. There's some type of change happening, and there's going to have to be a governmental response to it. And if your response is that it's not happening, it's going to be very hard for voters who come out in November. I mean, keep in mind, we had Hurricane Katrina. there's going to be very hard for voters just to say, well, you know, we shouldn't talk about it. It's not something that we should think about because it's not going to affect us. Well, it seems to be affecting everybody, and it's going to have to be discussed during the election.
Yeah, Rick, in the last minute that we have, we just have to mention the jobs report that's out. Just 38,000 jobs added. Donald Trump's tweeted, terrible jobs report. The head of the RNC tweeted, devastating report, a sign that the country needs to move away from Obama and Clinton policies. How do you think this might play out?
It's a suggestion to me that we don't actually know what the big issues that will animate voters in the fall will be. The economy has been back burner for a while. It could very easily come back. We know that voters are always concerned about those pocketbook issues, and there are clear contrasts between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And to the extent that Clinton is running on a third Obama term, the mixed sentiments around this economy will be critical. But the fact is, we just don't know where those metrics will stand in a few months.
Okay, well, we look ahead to next week where we're going to see how, on the Democratic side, things play out at the primaries. The Sanders campaign swearing they're going to do well. By the way, we left out yesterday the RNC tweeted 181 days since Hillary Clinton held a press conference. What's she hiding from? Emails? So we'll hear more about that. That's next week. Take the weekend off. Jesse Holland, manager of the AP Politics social media accounts. Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Posts on the website of the International Monetary Fund do not usually go viral, but this week one did. We'll look at the week in social media in a few minutes. Have you heard about the Emoji Bible? But to the IMF post, it was titled Neoliberalism Oversold? With a big question mark, questioning the so-called neoliberal policies promoted by the IMF and Western countries, and it was written by IMF researchers. It argues that policies like privatization and opening markets to foreign competition have some benefits, but they also lead to inequality, which can hurt growth. Ben Norton wrote in Salon, it was like reading the Pope declaring that there is no God. Now, the IMF has responded, saying the post has been widely misinterpreted and that the organization has been reevaluating its policies since the global financial crisis, but the process has not fundamentally changed the core of their approach. Simon Johnson is a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management, and he served as chief economist at the International Monetary Fund in 2007 and 8. So, Simon, let's get right to it. You were there. What do you make of this?
Well, look, the IMF has shifted its thinking a lot over the past 20 years, particularly in the light of what happened in Asia in 1997, 1998. And when I was there in 2007, 2008, I would say that process of reevaluation was underway. I didn't initiate it, but I did participate in it. I thought it was a pretty healthy process. And what you're seeing today in this article we're now discussing is a continuation of that reassessment.
Questioning it. Well, just back up and explain. What does it mean by saying the neoliberal policies? What does that mean?
All right. Well, I do think that the whoever put the headline on this IMF article might have oversold the headline as well as using the word oversold in the headline. Neoliberalism does refer to the idea that you can free up economies. You can, as you said, privatize assets, sell state enterprises. You can bring in more market determination. Freer markets was a big theme, for example, in Eastern Europe during the 1990s after the collapse of communism. And two key pieces are capital flows. Do you allow capital, money, to flow in and out of your country? And the IMF has now become much more skeptical about the general benefits of that, although sometimes it's a good idea. And the other thing, which – and this is really very central to our concerns in the United States today even – is fiscal austerity. When you've got a budget deficit and when you don't have a lot of overall pressure from the market, let's say your interest rates are low, people are willing to buy your debt domestically and around the world – how much emphasis should you put on fiscal austerity? Should you cut spending? Should you raise taxes? Should you rush to get the budget under control? Or now the IMF is saying, and I think on this dimension, to me, the article does represent a shifting of some important nuances. They're saying, slow down. Fiscal austerity, really not so important for some countries like the United States or the UK, for example, and allow the economy to grow. And as you grow, the debt should fall relative to GDP. But that would be a very gradual process.
Are they thinking there of Greece, for instance, which, you know, went with fiscal austerity and did not work?
Well, they don't say Greece. The word Greece is not mentioned in the article. But yes, I think Greece is very much on their minds. And I'm not sure, to be honest, that the IMF internally is in agreement among its own staff members about what happened in Greece and what should be done differently in other situations. But to many people on the outside, Greece does represent an unfortunate and extreme degree of fiscal austerity that has not been successful.
Well, and what do you think? I mean, the researchers, there's three of them, again, you know, question much of the economic policy. So talk about money going in and out of countries. Give us an example of that. What are they talking about?
Well, short-term money, short-term capital flows, hot money, money that shifts day in, day out from U.S. to London, from London to Tokyo, from Tokyo to somewhere else. And particularly if it's going in and out of countries with weak institutions where they don't have strong political setup, where they don't have good financial regulation, some of those capital inflows can be destabilizing. And I think a lot of countries, particularly middle-income countries, have learned the hard way. Money comes in, there's a tremendous boom, some people become very rich. And that generates a lot of friction. Maybe that undermines political legitimacy. I think, though, the bigger issue is what it does to the financial system. And the piece that's actually still missing a little bit from the IMF thinking is financial regulation and the way in which you allow finance to get out of control in many situations, the way that leads to a great boom. Everyone feels good, but then you have a tremendous bust. And in that bust, a lot of people are driven down into poverty.
Well, is there another piece, too, that may correlate with the concern in this country now about trade? That, yes, you may have a boom in some parts, but a bust in others. You just said that money may flow into maybe a poor or middle class country, and yet the money goes to the few, and maybe ultimately if there's a bust, more people are poor. And then if more people are poor, they're not buying more things, and so you're not getting the desired expansion that you wanted.
Well, it's certainly true that in the discussions we're having right now about trade in the United States, particularly the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, the issue of inequality absolutely comes up. So it is the case that the trade agreements, generally speaking, increase GDP, but many of them also create a lot of opportunities for relatively few people and perhaps cheaper goods for other people. So they may gain as consumers, but they may also lose their jobs. And the people who lose their jobs could, in principle, be compensated, and this is in every economics model, that the winners could compensate the losers and everyone would still be better off. But the central political reality in the United States is we do not compensate the losers. And if you just remember that and think about that, when you're thinking about trade, you understand why so many people are reluctant at this stage to support an agreement like TPP. Yeah.
Well, again, as we're understanding it, the policies that the IMF researchers are talking about, as you said, a flow of money into countries, increasing privatization of investments. These are the policies of Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher. What happens now? What does this mean?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not sure it means very much, actually. I don't think the IMF is changing its ability or inclination to lend to countries. But you're right. If we go back to the 1980s in the U.S. and in the U.K., there was absolutely a view that growth was a thing to go for. Everything else could and would trickle down to other people and that a rising tide will lift all boats. Turns out that's not the right metaphor. And many people have got left behind. Median wages have not gone up. Many people have been pushed out of the middle class by what's happened in terms of technology change, as well as trade, as well as other developments such as the decline of trade unions over the past 25 years.
Simon Johnson, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute in Washington. He also served as chief economist at the International Monetary Fund in 2007 and 2008. Always a pleasure, Simon. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll link you to that post from the IMF and some of the reaction at hereandnow.org, where we'll also have, as we always do, other social media stories of the week. This week, they include an emoji version of the Bible and a proposed bill in Pakistan allowing, you know, light domestic abuse. What Femi Okay hosts the stream on Al Jazeera English in Washington. Femi, first to the emoji-fied Bible, that little haloed figure comes
yes.
in handy.
Yes. Explain. I should really say smiley face, thumbs up, wave, Robin, rather than hello, but how are you?
I'm fine, and halo back to you.
Thank you.
Yes. So what is this?
All right. So it's a Bible emoji, and it is the entire Bible translated into scripture for millennials. That is what it is. 3,000 pages of emojis.
Is it all emojis? I've seen some pictures. There seem to be some words.
There are some words connecting the emojis, because if it was all emojis, you would have a massive headache. But there are things like there would be a halo emoji and then God, which would be like a smiley face emoji, saw that it was good. Thumbs up was good. He saw the light bulb. I think you understand what I'm saying here. At Bible emoji will actually you can picture it perfectly there because you can see little excerpts from the Bible emoji there.
Well, and we understand that the translator is anonymous and told the Daily News, the New York Daily News, the Bible more than any other book has a really rich history of translation. I think that's one of the beautiful things about emojis. And I think one of the goals of using them was to point out in the Bible, God's love is for everyone, not select people. What are people saying online?
There's a lot of love and a little bit of hate and a lot of terrible biblical puns. I'm talking about you, Mark Maybaum. I was lost on Twitter and then I found at Bible Emoji. But Donna White makes a really good point. She says, thou shalt read at Bible Emoji daily. It is a great idea to diversify the greatest book on earth and to make it more accessible for young people. And one of the nice things about if you tweet with at Bible Emoji with the author, he tweets right back. So even when you say, I'm offended, he says, I'm sorry you're offended. That wasn't my intent. And people are sharing new emojis for him to help him with a better translation. So you can actually talk to him, talk to the Bible emoji and help him make it better.
If it's a him. It's kind of the same question about God. But yes. Moving on to something on the other end of the spectrum. We'll link people to the Bible emoji at hearnow.org. But this proposed bill in Pakistan that would make it legal for husbands to lightly beat their wives. Who is proposing this?
Let's take one step back. In the region of Punjab in India, there is a women's protection bill which is going through with legislators. And there is a committee and a council of Islamic ideology who advises the legislators. Now, what they advise, the legislators don't have to do. But the advisors, the scholar advisors, were saying that there are some circumstances, some severe circumstances, where it is okay to lightly beat your wife. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the advice that's been given to the legislators as they try to put together this women's protection bill.
Well, and what's been the reaction? And by the way, is the reaction on social media from Pakistan or outside?
It went viral from within Pakistan. A Pakistani photographer called Farhad Arajpur did a photo essay off the back of this lightly beat your wife suggestion. He had the hashtag try beating me lightly and then took pictures of women and their responses. And that went viral. And so try beating me lightly is viral. It's ironic. It's humorous. It's fierce. Let me give you an example of one of the comments.
Yep.
I'll become the destruction you will never want to see, try beating me lightly.
Huh. Femi Okay hosts the stream on Al Jazeera English with the things that are percolating on social media. Important story there. Femi, thanks so much.
You're always so welcome. Thanks, Robin.
The monthly jobs report is out from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it's not good. Last month, the economy added just 38,000 jobs, the smallest monthly addition in more than 5 years. Well, joining us now for a closer look is Mike Regan. He's with Bloomberg Gadfly. Hi there, Mike.
Hi, Magna.
So first of all, your reaction to these low numbers?
Well, to use the technical jargon, I would say it was a very weird month. You know, you see the payroll number be much weaker than expected, about a quarter of the job growth that economists estimated. But yet the unemployment rate actually did much better than economists had estimated. It dropped from 5% to 4.7%, which is the lowest since 2007. And it really highlights the fact that one of these numbers, the report that tallies the numbers of jobs added, is based on a survey of businesses, while the unemployment rate is based on a survey of households. So sometimes they can give much different pictures of what's going on. I talked to an economist friend of mine who said, yeah, it's complicated, but if they made it any simpler, all of us economists would be out of work. So the numbers would be even worse then.
But I wonder if there's, I mean, to that point, is there an oversimplification going on here? Because, I mean, that low 4.7 unemployment rate looks good on paper, but I always take that number with a grain of salt because we continuously see people just exiting the job market altogether.
Yeah, and that's a big, the employment participation rate did decline during the month. And that is a number that had stabilized at very low levels. So it is disappointing to a lot of people to see that decline again. Whereas it's a sort of a tough number to really figure out exactly what's going on with. Obviously, some people drop out of the workforce because they're just frustrated. They can't find a job. But a lot of people drop out because they retire early or, you know, they put their kids through college. college and they don't need to work. Both people in a couple don't need to work anymore. So it's a complicated number, but in general, most people like to see that number moving higher,
yeah,
with more people in the labor force, and that's considered a more positive sign for the economy.
Yeah. Now, Mike, I try not to look at data points in isolation. We also see that in this report, the government revised down the number of jobs added in March and April by 59,000. So is this more than just an off month? Is there a trend here?
Well, you're absolutely right. You shouldn't read too much into one single month. It could be an anomaly that's corrected next month. But there does seem to be a trend, not really that surprising of a trend, that job growth is weakening to some degree, because we are reaching that level of unemployment that is where, approaching full employment in the economy. But looking at the mix of jobs this month, there are some reasons to be concerned. Employment in professional and business services was changed very little, an increase of about 10,000 compared to 55,000 in April. And those are good, office jobs, good paying, good benefits. Other major industries, construction, financial activities, leisure and hospitality, even government jobs were all little changed over the month. So it does seem, it does make you worry that this job growth is slowing more, yeah, than people had expected.
And Mike, in just a couple seconds, really, Janet Yellen was expected to maybe even raise rates, but could this new report change Fed policy?
Yeah, absolutely. The futures contracts on the federal funds rate have indicated that there's very little chance of a rate increase this month, and not much of a chance for July either.
Mike Regan, columnist with Bloomberg Gadfly. Thanks as always, Mike.
Thank you.
Sumner Redstone is the 93-year-old media mogul who controls 80% of the voting shares in CBS and Viacom. His empire is estimated at $40 billion. His company, born of his dad's Boston drive-in theaters, is called National Amusements. Just 2 weeks ago, he fired Viacom CEO and a board member, Philippe Dumont and George Abrams. He'd already fired them from his own trust and board. He's also fired former love interests / caretakers. And everyone is suing and questioning his competency, saying his daughter Shari is pulling his strings. Well, now a granddaughter, the daughter of Shari's brother Brent, is also starting a lawsuit. But Sumner Redstone, as you'll hear, is a survivor. William Cohen is a contributing editor for Vanity Fair. We'll link you to his profiles of Sumner Redstone, which nicely set up the Shakespearean drama we're now seeing play out. So, William, start with Sidney Holland, his most recent live-in lover, and Manuela Hirscher, a former lover-turned-friend, both recently fired.
Yeah, these two women were sitting pretty. I mean, literally. Huge beneficiaries of his will to the tune of around $75 million each. And they'd also, through their wily charms, convinced Sumner to give them each around another $70 million each. And so they both leave sort of sitting on $150 million each, either to come or already in the bank, which had afforded them a wonderful lifestyle of homes around Beverly Hills. And with Sidney, unbeknownst to Sumner, she was using his credit card to fly around on private jets to visit a boyfriend in Sedona, Arizona. So she was cheating on Sumner at the same time she was living with him without him knowing it.
Well, look, I mean, you've painted not a very pretty picture. And some would say, look, Sumner Redstone knows exactly what's going on in his life all the time. Nobody ever tells him what to do. And this was what he wanted, these two women in his life. But then we all saw the recent court case play out, where a judge said in no uncertain terms to Manuela Hirscher that, in fact, Sumner was competent and did not need her. That just played out recently, and now both women are out of the house. But all of the people around him that he has cut off are saying it's Shari Redstone, Sumner's daughter, that is behind all of this. You actually used the word coup?
Yes. It is a corporate coup. She has gone out of her way to make sure everybody thinks that she has reconciled with her father after many years of a bad relationship. As far as we can tell, that's basically true. Again, it's not true how cognizant Sumner is on a day-to-day basis, despite the fact of what the judge said, you're correct, about a month ago to Manuela Hirscher. But there's no question that those two women are out of his life, that Philippe Dumont and George Abrams have been removed from the board of National Amusements and are no longer members of the all-important seven-person trust that will take control of National Amusements once Sumner dies, if he ever dies, and that Sherry Redstone is now absolutely controlling what's going on. There's a, you know, massive sort of lawsuits that are starting where they're fighting this all out. But Sherry has absolutely reinstated herself in this, whether Sumner is aware of it or not.
And some people would applaud that. You know, great, let the daughter that he raised, who knows the business, get hangers-on out of the way and step in. But the point is, we don't really know a lot of this because a lot of these family infighting, you know, money doesn't always end well stories. It's like an accident that maybe we should look away from, except that he has such an important role in two very big companies. Why is this story important? Because of the bigger picture of how connected he is to both Viacom and CBS?
That's basically why, you know, a lot of people wonder, you know, on Wall Street, if these two companies will, in fact, be in play should he die.
And really?
Trust. Well, absolutely. I mean, there's no requirement that these companies be sold. But when effectively this family controls 80% of the voting rights of both of these companies, and the beneficiaries of that stock that they own, that voting stock, are the grandchildren, then, of course, that starts many people thinking, what's going to happen to CBS and Viacom? Are they going to be sold? And I think at some point they will be sold. That's why everybody's sort of agitated about this, because whenever there's a big deal in the works or potentially big deal in the works for important media companies, everybody, especially in the media, you know, starts buzzing wildly.
Well, and complicating all of this is that he is a character. People here in Boston know that. We knew him back when he was Sumner Redstone, who ran theaters. You know, I have a friend who was one of his numbers guys, and she used to have to give him the box office receipts. And she would say, well, Theater One took in $1,800,052. He said, oh, no, it was 54 cents. He had a photographic memory. He knew his numbers. He was driven. Tell us more about how he went from theaters to the mogul you've described.
Well, you know, I'm from Massachusetts, too. I grew up in Worcester, so I would see the Showcase cinemas right. Go up there, and they were mind-blowing because they were the first time that there were these multiplex cinemas. They were not run down. They were beautiful. They got the first-run films. It was just – they were air-conditioned. It was something to behold. And, you know, Sumner – what people forget about Sumner is that he's – an incredibly smart man, went to Harvard and Harvard Law School. He was a tax lawyer for a long time. So, I mean, all these tax schemes that he has set up are done with incredible skill and knowledge of the tax laws and how to sort of take advantage of them in the best way. He could also be a very ruthless businessman. He cut out his brother and his father out of the business. He obviously had a falling out with his son, Brett, and basically another one with Sherry, his daughter, although they've reconciled. But even 2 years ago, Sumner was trying to buy Sherry out of National Amusements for $1 billion, and eventually Sherry turned that down.
So he clawed his way, but with great—
Literally.
Yeah, with great intelligence. And there was also an event that, I don't mean to be inappropriate here, but it literally burnished him. He was in a hotel fire in Boston, 79, I think, hung
yes.
off a windowsill.
Yes, and was rescued by on the third floor of the hotel. And again, not to be inappropriate, but he was with, I believe, someone who was not his wife. He clung from the windowsill, and a fire engine below sent up a ladder up three stories, and literally with the flames licking at his body, clung on until he was rescued, and he was burned on a substantial part of his body, and he's, you know, his hands are all deformed now, and he's got scars. But he is an incredible fighter, obviously, and yeah. a determined individual. And he benefited in the 1980s from the creation of what we now call the high yield market. And Mike Milken, who created that, the so-called junk bond market, he was able to use money that Mike Milken had raised for him to buy Viacom, besting other suitors for that company. And then he bought Paramount, again doing the same thing. And then he bought CBS. So this is a guy who is a determined, smart individual and takes no prisoners.
Well, and now he's convinced. I mean, was he serious when he told you this, that he literally isn't going to die? Was he kidding?
Well, he's told that to several people. He said it at a Mike Milken conference several years ago. He you know, he would get a new girlfriend, he'd get a new diet, and proclaim that he wasn't going to die. But ever since September 2014, he really has been in very difficult health. He had a tracheotomy, and he hasn't been able to speak well. He can't really move very well.
You describe a scene in which he's carried into a big meeting on a chair behind a curtain. So if you have somebody with this much control over companies who's convinced he isn't going to die, he's not preparing to die.
Well, so this whole issue of a chairman's health, of a principal shareholder's health, these are ongoing issues that companies across the country are wrestling with how much disclosure to make. And in this case, you know, there are real serious governance issues at the corporate board level of Viacom about whether they've done the right thing, they've disclosed enough to shareholders about Sumner's condition. I mean, there's one of the reasons that Philippe Daumont, the CEO of Viacom, is in so much hot water now with Sumner is because he last October said that Sumner was in great physical condition and was the same old Sumner. And now he's arguing that he was incompetent and couldn't make decisions when he threw him off the Board of National Amusements last week. So Philippe Daumont is trying to have it both ways. At the same time, Viacom stock has underperformed the market. It's one of the worst performing media stocks in the last few years. And Philippe Daumont's board has awarded him with something like $50 million plus of compensation. And a lot of people are left scratching their heads about how that could have happened.
Yeah. Well, something tells me we'll continue to scratch our heads as the story unfolds. William Cohen is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, and we'll link you to his writing about Sumner Redstone at hearandnow.org. Bill, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Summer is around the corner, and that means there are new TV shows to check out. On Tuesday, Hulu brings back its hit comedy drama Casual for a second season. And on June 17th, Netflix releases season 4 of Orange is the New Black. Can't wait. But what about the networks and cable? Well, joining us to talk summer TV is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, good to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure.
All right. So first of all, tell us, what are the trends we should be looking for in this year's summer shows?
So summer, it used to be a time when TV would kind of slow down a little bit. Network TV would go into reruns and cable TV would step up, but, you know, they didn't have the kind of programming that we see on the cable channels now. Summer now, first of all, the summer season starts right away. Cable TV ramps up a bit more. Network television is starting to fill up with these reality shows, if you noticed. There's MasterChef on Fox. NBC has a whole suite of reality shows. And one of the shows that they have is America's Got Talent. Now, this is one of their biggest summer shows. And it features a change. Howard Stern used to be the judge on the show, the fourth judge on the show, along with Howie Mandel and Mel B and Heidi Klum. And he left the show, and now Simon Cowell, who has always been an executive producer on the show, is going to join it. So we're going to see him. We're seeing him on American television for the first time since his show got canceled on Fox and he left American Idol. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, the original acerbic judge coming back to judge a talent competition. I think we have a clip.
Is he really going to behave himself?
He better.
Is all of this necessary? I don't actually bite.
I'm not actually sure that's true.
Exactly. And if he
didn't, I think he might actually bite.
What would be the point if he didn't?
Exactly. That's what makes this show so interesting. You wonder if he's going to jump over the panel and attack somebody. So there you go.
Well, we also, I mean, speaking of NBC, I see that the network also just launched a new variety show from Lorne Michaels, creator of Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, it's called Maya and Marty, and it features Maya Rudolph, who used to be on Saturday Night Live, and Martin Short. And we have a clip. Why don't we just check out a little bit of it and hear their little their interesting chemistry?
Now, how are your two kids?
Actually, four kids, Marty.
Four kids?
Yeah.
My God, you're not a woman. You're a pitching machine.
Thank you.
Yeah, try the veal. You've been magically transported back to the Catskills. So this is a show that has a sketch comedy. It has some pre-taped bits. They had an A-list roster of guests appearing, including Tom Hanks and Steve Martin. But it feels a lot like Saturday Night Live in prime time, which is kind of odd. So an interesting experiment.
We'll see if it's successful or not. Let's switch genres entirely and move over to what's happening tonight, I believe, on Cinemax. There's a new show out for horror junkies. I see that fans of The Walking Dead are going to be happy to know that that show's creator, Robert Kirkman, is back with a new show called Outcast. Tell us about that.
This is about a mysterious person who apparently has some sort of connection to demons that are possessing people in this small town. And it's almost as if these demons are following him, but he also has the key to defeating them. I think we have a clip of that, too.
Something's going on in this town. People are afraid.
These things are everywhere.
Everywhere. When the drums are rolling like that, you know it can't be good.
Exactly.
Even scarier than The Walking Dead?
I don't know about that. The Walking Dead is pretty darn scary. But this is, I think, scarier in a subtler way. And we don't quite know why this guy is at the center of it. And so it's interesting to sort of hear his backstory and find out what his backstory is and how it relates to this seemingly expanding series of demonic possession events. Yeah.
Now, overall, Eric, I mean, is summer a time for sort of lighter fare anymore in TV? Or are we seeing, you know, a different kind of summer programming, maybe more experimentation?
There is a sense that you can experiment a little, but there's also a sense that if you have something that you know is going to be a hit, that you know is really successful, you're not necessarily going to air it in summer. So we're seeing, for example, you know, AMC is trying an ambitious show called Feed the Beast that features David Schwimmer, who used to be on Friends. And it's about these two childhood friends who are down on their luck, and they decide to try and start an upscale Greek restaurant together in the Bronx. Now, this is something that AMC, it's a kind of show that AMC doesn't really do often. They're trying it out at a time when they have some comic book shows on, like Preacher, that are going to do well. But it's a good time for them to experiment. They're not going to mess with The Walking Dead and Fear the Walking Dead and Better Call Saul, these shows that are clearly working for them in the heart of the TV season in the fall and spring. So we're going to see a little bit more of this, especially on the networks, but also in cable.
Well, that's Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic, walking us through what we can expect from summer TV. Eric, always great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Robin, this is Sasha Dobson's music for Feed the Beast.
Which sounds wonderful, but Meghna, I'm still watching last year's The Americans. I can't even catch up.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Jeremy Hobson's back Monday. I'm Robin Young.